Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Carson's Corner, the MMA show. My name is Bob Carson, and we're pleased to be with you here this evening. 347-326-9749 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. And we also have the chat room open for those that want to chime in. Coming up on today's show, we have Dan Quinn. The second part of our update with Dan Quinn, it only lasts about 15 minutes or so. But I think that when you listen to this, you'll be able to get an idea of Dan's situation as far as when he's going to, you know, go to trial, what's happening. It's been over a year now since Dan has been locked up. Dan was locked up last year in August, and now, you know, things have changed with Dan. We heard on the first update that Dan lost his jail privileges. He was involved in an altercation where somebody allegedly came into his cell and Dan knocked him out, and they took away his phone privileges. And so that's why he wasn't here on Carson's Corner for this past month or so, a couple months actually. The last update we got with Dan was September. So it's been quite a while and whatnot. So that's coming up. We also have our guest co-host, Justin Ray Harvey. From time to time, you know, Justin is the co-host of my political show, and he does some shows about combat sports when he can, when he's available. And he interviewed David Wirth. He is the director of the movie Kickboxer. And this is something, you know, you remember Kickboxer with that really menacing-looking kickboxer? Tong Po was his name in the film. And this guy just absolutely looked the part. I'm sure he has some sort of martial art background, but you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme was in Kickboxer, and I think David Wirth was actually involved in Bloodsport as well. And those of you who followed me know that I am very good friends with Frank Dukes, a man who really needs no introduction whatsoever. I'm actually friends with him, and that's how I was introduced to Justin. And so we're going to play that interview. That's going to be about 20 minutes or so. But before we do, you know, it's been such a long time since I spoke about The Ultimate Fighter. This show, Carson's Corner, started in 2006, I want to say, with the advent of The Ultimate Fighter. Okay, it was in the first season of The Ultimate Fighter, and this show was in its infancy. And we were very, very controversial, as you recall. We insulted a lot of the cast members of The Ultimate Fighter. I had Tate Fletcher basically threatening me online. I had Rory Singer. I mean, I called Rory Singer the Florence Nightingale of MMA, which, you know, it's bad to take personal shots at fighters. We developed a reputation from our show, which is very, very low budget back then. Really, it was the quality was not very good. But nonetheless, we managed to get a lot of internet reaction. A lot of people just, to this day, people still remember that. That was, Carson's Corner dominated the forums for about 2 or 3 years or so. And we certainly developed a reputation among some. But over the years, we've matured into the best MMA interview show out there. I mean, you will not find MMA interviews elsewhere like here on Carson's Corner. You just won't. I mean, whether you tune into the folks over at SiriusXM Fight Club, okay, it's all these guys that, you know, some of them follow MMA full-time, but it's corporate radio. It's, you know, 5-10 minutes with the fighter, and that's it. They can't go beyond the corporate talking points. And we here on Carson's Corner offer I'm going to say the most comprehensive, informative, well-researched interviews on the planet. There's just no question about that. And that's why we've survived for going on 8 years now. Okay, this show, whether you like it or not, is part of MMA. And Dana White on the forums actually suggested or actually implied that he had no idea who I am or who this show is, which is absolutely ridiculous because Dana White has replied to many of my tweets. He definitely knows who Carson's Corner is. We've interviewed high-level UFC officials and fighters, and Dana White knows. Dana White has his ear to the ground, but even if he didn't, it wouldn't make a difference because Dana White would hate the show. He would hate me because I am, from the same ilk of Eddie Goldman. I am essentially a follower of Eddie Goldman. Eddie was the reason why I started this show in the first place. And you recall in 2006, when I first started the show, Eddie was on a bit of a hiatus. And then I started the show, and then the IFL came around, and then Eddie started doing shows again. But Eddie, Dana White hates Eddie. Eddie actually had Dana White on his show in 2001 when Eddie was on IATA. And, Dana White hates John Peretti, who was on our last MMA show. And he hates anybody that has a non-corporate point of view. He hates anyone that asks the wrong questions or makes the wrong point, which is why Zuffa is very, very selective over the media that they choose to engage with. So, Bob Carson, Carson's Corner, Eddie Goldman of No Holds Barred, and other, quote, non-credentialed media figures, which some writer for Yahoo mentioned the other day when speaking about Dana White and his addressing the Underground Forum about retiring. We do not make the corporate filtering process, and that's an honor. I wear it as a badge of honor because nowadays, and you heard it from John Peretti, and you'll hear it from others, MMA fans, by and large, are just analyzing fights and results and this and that, whatever the corporate media wants them to analyze, as opposed to whether or not the UFC is actually good for the sport of MMA, whether or not Dana White and the Zuffa's business model is actually hurting fighters. I mean, there's a whole host of questions that are not even allowed to be addressed on the Zuffa Shills sites and radio shows, and that's by design. It's part of a propaganda model, and it's not a conspiracy. It's the way media is in America. But our show, took off in 2006 with The Ultimate Fighter. It's been so long since I've had any type of commentary on The Ultimate Fighter, and I figured I'd talk about this season's Ultimate Fighter reality shows. You probably know I've been really bored with the incredibly stale format and fairly low level of talent, mismatches and boring sparring sessions and so on and so forth. And, how long can this show last, really? Is it producing contenders? Is it, even with Ronda and Misha, look at the ratings. As far as I can tell, the numbers that I've seen suggest that the ratings are going down. However, I am a fan of MMA, and women's MMA. I'm definitely a fan of its competitors. So I checked out a little bit of this season to see if, they would bring anything new to the show. And honestly, I think I like the female fighters. Female fighters are very, very exciting. And some of their personalities on the show I thought were entertaining. And yet, still with all of that, I think that from what I've seen and the reaction that I've read suggests that the season was horrible. But why is that? Well, because it was the inclusion of the male fighters, of course. Some people will say that the UFC was worried that wouldn't draw on their own. And that may be the case. But I think they also gambled on a co-ed season in the ridiculous and naive hope that fighters would, quote, hook up and provide a ratings boost. And that's what they do at these Ultimate Fighter houses. You know, they just have alcohol accessible to everybody, and it's basically this environment, and this is what I was talking about earlier. It's this environment where basically, you know, there are no values in it, and, you know, bad behavior and getting in somebody's face and fighting outside the ring and all this stuff is rewarded. And this is the type of behavior that values that the UFC pushes out there. There's no question about that. But, you know, as a journalist, as someone that covers this, I do have to watch it. I do, because many of you tune into this show to listen to my reaction, my analysis of the Ultimate Fighter. So I don't completely disregard it like some other figures do. And, you know, having said that, let me tell you something. And we're going to go back to the Ultimate Fighter. But, you know, I watch every single UFC event I can, the pay-per-view events. And I watch the Ultimate Fight Nights and the events in general. So it would be a hypocrite for me to not note that and say, yeah, you know, to a certain extent, the UFC and Dana White and others put a product out there that I want to see because I'm a fan of the sport itself, and they have all the fighters. So, you know, if you want to call me a hypocrite, that's fine. You could do it. But going back to the Ultimate Fighter, I think they're crazy. I don't think they did their research. Do they know anything about reality shows? At first, I thought the idea was risky and hazardous. But then I actually considered it for more than 30 seconds and remembered that the so-called co-ed reality shows like The Real World have been on for years with fairly uninteresting results. And it took until 2003 and the UK's Teen Big Brother season for there to be confirmed sex in that particular part of the reality show, which encourages contestants to humiliate and degrade themselves for fame as a matter of course. The idea that these male fighters with their cheesy pickup lines would be, you know, hooking up with some females is just ridiculous. So I don't know. I just thought there was a problem with the reality show, and it didn't really go over well. And I don't know. Then you also had two fighters missing weight in, I think it was a 135 and 125 pound division, where massive weight cutting is the rule rather than an exception. And I don't think some of these fighters can safely make the weight as many times as the show requires. I mean, Cody Bollinger did not look human at 135, and only sometimes in a good way. He looked like some sort of alien. And no disrespect for him, but I think he had the neck of a 135-pound fighter. He resembled Mechaneck, the character from He-Man with the robot neck, or Fight Club author Chuck Palahniuk. The worst part is that it seemed like one of the top dogs were along with DJ Davey and Chris. Hopefully he learns from it and doesn't keep trying to make 135 pounds if you know, he can manage to. And seriously, the less said about the doofus Anthony Gutierrez, the better. You know, this guy was so relieved not to fight in the quarterfinals that he pigged out immediately and put on a bunch of weight he couldn't then sweat off. He made himself look as bad as possible all season long, right from the start. Missing weight was just, I think, the icing of the cake, and we'll see if he's going to be in the UFC. People give Gabe Rudiger a hard time, and that was justified, but at least he made the show, you know, and he wanted to try to cut weight. But, you know, I don't know. Whatever you say, Gabe, I think Gabe Rudiger has actually criticized us online. But what about some of the females on the show I enjoyed watching? I found myself sort of attracted to Peggy Morgan. I mean, I guess English, the English accent kind of attracted me. And what I don't know. Some other fighters were intriguing. I'm actually a friend of some of these female fighters on Facebook. And going back to Peggy Morgan, I think she seems to be a good fighter with a lot of upside. But she's still pretty raw at this stage. We'll see in a couple of years how it turns out for Peggy. I'm hoping for good things from her. She seems like she really can put it on people when she steps on the gas. As long as they don't take her down, pull guard, push her up against the cage, and a few other things. Hey, those things will come with time. Maybe we can get her on a show in order to help with my creative writing. Can you imagine a series of detective novels with realistic MMA radio-themed content in them? That'd be better than the crap that John Rain novels by Barry Eisler. Donnie, let's pretend I never said that and get Barry Eisler on the show for an ambush interview. That'd be absolutely funny. But, I don't know. It's the whole, we're going to see what's going to happen next year, whether the Ultimate Fighter is going to be on the air anymore. I don't know. Does anybody want to see, Frankie Edgar versus BJ Penn? I don't know. Who knows? They could be on for longer. I really don't know. But who knows? What else do we have going on here? Let's go to my Dan Quinn update. We have Dan Quinn that we spoke to earlier on, and this is earlier on in the month. And we got to play you the first update with Dan Quinn, which is about 44 minutes or so. And we have to go to the second one. We didn't have time to play the second one on the program. So without further ado, let's go to my second update with Dan Quinn. This is part two of our update with Dan Quinn. It's about 15 minutes long. Okay, so here it is. Dan Quinn from the Sacramento County Jail.
I see solutions. You may begin speaking now.
Dan, when we last left off, we were trying to get an estimate from you as to when you'd think you'd be out.
That's good. I mean, my fucking public defenders, okay, who have to be a part of that equation, if it's the highest overturn rate, highest conviction rate, there's something fucking seriously going wrong, okay? The district attorney for San Francisco has to let that stabbing suspect go, even though his head fucking says, he did it in self-defense because they don't have enough evidence, but you know what? That dude is washed. He's done, okay? $500,000 bail, no bail bond, okay? And they're going to fuck him over. So with me, okay, I want to go to court, Bob. Want to know why? You know what I said, Bob? I thought about it when I was in the back of the car. I said, I should have shot you when you walked up. Question, Bob, is I should have shot you, is that a threat? Or is that a past tense statement on something that I should have done?
It doesn't constitute an imminent threat.
No, it's not an imminent threat. And then you know what I said, Bob? I said, no threat, okay? This isn't a threat, but, down the road when I get money and I'm rich, I'm going to fucking find your family and I'm going to buy the fucking houses next to them. I said this before on videotapes, right? I'm going to buy the houses next to them, fill it with people that hate their fucking guts, crash property values, ruin the quality of their life. They're going to end up hating your fucking guts, okay? Because this fucking punk is basically arresting me, okay, because he doesn't like me, because they raided my house, because on my record says there's an attempted murder on a cop. Seriously, okay? And I'll tell you what, Bob. This is, you asked me about my roommate, my cellie, okay, Bryce Peeler.
Mm-hmm.
Bryce Peeler, in his case, Sergeant McKenzie from Placer County allegedly finds the gun that Bryce supposedly had, okay? Well, you know what Sergeant McKenzie did to me, Bob? When I was arrested, okay, I was handcuffed in a fucking restraining chair for 22 hours straight, okay? That broke protocol, broke the law, okay? They had to take me to the hospital, and then they let me go from court. And then, after they let me go from court free, because I hadn't done anything wrong, you know what they did, Bob? They spied that attempted murder on a police officer out of Miami, okay? Supposedly, I yelled, I have AIDS, and don't have, okay, bullshit, okay, well, you know what they did? They rearrested me in that sting, Bob, okay, and McKenzie lied and said that I spit on him, and he thought that he was going to have a prior out of Miami to take in front of a judge, saying, you know what, Your Honor, we didn't have the fucking video camera, you know, was broken or whatever, but he has a prior, they were going to try to send me to prison for a long time. I ended up pleading basically to fucking anything to get the fuck out because I knew Stevie saved lives, alright? And guess what? That's gonna give me an opportunity to tell the truth about Sergeant McKenzie and Bryce's lawsuit for his case. But in mind, Bob, they should let me go, okay? I'm eventually gonna win a Nobel Prize for... Okay, here's a question, Bob. Awesome. Have you hooked up with Riley Price yet to get the stevia so you can slim down and you can go fucking lean and ripped up?
I called Riley. I spoke to him. He's supposed to send it to me. I've never received any stevia from him.
Okay. Didn't you tell me that there was somebody out there that was willing to fucking set up some kind of fund to get me fucking released from jail or something like that?
Oh, Jan Johannesson. Yeah, he's another one of your fans, Dan. He recorded a whole album dedicated to you. And I got to read the specifics, but he emailed me some sort of an idea to put up a charity fund for you to help you out and everything like that. I'll know more details when I read the email, but yeah, absolutely.
Jeff Cooper, okay, have a kilo of Emperor's Apologist TV. Jeff, I'll tell you what, this shit... the shit out of cocaine. Now, I'm not sure if it's just the combination with THC that makes it so fucking strong, but ex-methamphetamine took Jeff Cooper, a friend of mine. He actually did a line of stevia, the pure stuff from Emperor's Apologist, and he was spun for an hour and a half, okay? So, Jeff, if you could actually have a kilo sent to Bob Carson so Bob could start going lean and ripped and get this fucking, you know, party started, I'll actually repay you out of the 10 to 12 kilos that I have right now at my house, okay? And even if you know what, Bob, put it like this. Do you think, seriously, do you think it's a story, okay? Do you think it's a saleable story, okay? A for sure first-round NFL draft, Bob, okay? I'm 6'3", I'm 235 pounds, I run a 4.67 40. I just saw an article on Rolando McClain, okay? He played at Alabama. He's the guy that quit football. He ran a 4.68, and supposedly they were elevated. But most guys, when they run a 40, Bob, I don't know if you realize this, when they hit the 40-yard marker, they're topped out. That's as fast as they can go. Are you aware of that, Frank?
No, but it makes sense.
Okay, yeah. Most guys, when they hit the 40-yard marker, okay, they're not going to get any faster. They're topped out. I had black sprinters saying, God damn, that white boy is changing gears, okay? I was fucking the fastest motherfucker on the field, okay, sideline to sideline. I had 6.5 sacks in the 86 spring game. I covered Alan Pinkett and Ricky Waters man-to-man. He didn't catch a fucking pass, Bob, okay? Cedric Figaro, a linebacker for the Chargers, tells me that I'm better than every linebacker that he plays with, but since Holt hate me, I'm going to have to go to the fucking CFL and wreck it and then come back down. And Miley Cyrus and Madonna, okay, the Eminem twins, you know what I said? I said, fuck football, okay? I would have these monster football coaches killed. I had already talked to some of my friends that were borderline in the criminal fucking community, Bob, okay? And Jerry Sandusky, okay, raping kids, he deserves the death penalty, even fucking worse. But I'll tell you what, Bob, okay? You can rape people in different ways, and that's what Holtz did, man. Martin Luther King should have been a first-team All-American. He should have been in the NFL, okay? He handled Tony Siragusa in high school football. I saw it. Jerry Faust recruited me, okay? Here's a question, Bob. How many guys get handed number 55? You know what number 55 is, right, in football? I mean, in the linebacker, doesn't that denote the fucking, like, junior now, right?
Okay, yeah.
Okay? Yeah, Jerry Faust rolled out number 55 to me at Notre Dame. And I said, no, I'm cool, I want 41, okay? And there's a potential, Bob, if Russ Purnell, when Russ Purnell recruited me at USC, he was in shape, he was fucking, he looked like a movie star, okay? He was that handsome, my mom couldn't stand him, okay? If he gets gets me a job up, I'm at USC. I'm covering black guys, men and men, all over the field. I'm in the NFL. And so now that the Stevie Discovery fucking, you know, is in my back pocket, everybody in Football America has already tried Stevie. Okay? It's already fucking global. It's done. Okay? Now, don't you think that's a fairly sellable story? Me saying basically, fuck it, I would have monster football coaches killed. Okay? What do you think, Bob? Do you think that story would sell?
Absolutely. And Jeff Cooper has actually said that your story would make a great movie, a great book. And a lot of people have said that. I mean, it's really amazing.
Oh, yeah. Bottom line, man, okay? Money is the essence of all evil, Bob. It really is, okay? I was at Notre Dame. I was set up for an attempted rape that a priest's testimony proved was a lie, Bob, fucking lie, okay? Said that my stereo was blaring so loud that this plea for help couldn't be heard. Well, you know what? The priest knocked at the door in the 2-minute time window that we're talking about, maybe 2-3 minutes, okay? It wasn't a long period of time. It was right after everybody had left my room because they thought I was going to get busy with Patsy McGowan. And knock, knock, knock at the door. We fucking froze, Bob. And then when the priest had actually left, okay, the freshman that threw the party for me, okay, because my picture, you've seen the picture of me winning the bingo bus, right?
Yes.
Okay, that picture, dude, I was a superstar coming back in the early morning, a superstar, okay? I came in, the freshman at this, and I can't remember what hall it was that I was living in, but they threw a party for me because I was a fucking superstar coming back. And when the priest left the door, okay, Cassie and I got up, and there was a knock at the door. They said, hey, he's on, come on. And the freshman that threw the party helped us get down to the fucking bus stop. I kissed this bitch goodnight, okay? She went home. Okay, and guess what? Her fucking older sister was the roommate of the bitch that attacked me, and I slapped. I said, get the fuck off me, cunt. You're not my mom, okay? You know, like Cary Grant, you know, letting bitches slap him? Fuck that. If a bitch slaps me, she's gonna get slapped back. I don't give a fuck, okay? Does that make me sound like an asshole? Okay? But it's legal. You wanna know why? Because I was in Old Sacramento one time with my friend, Brett McGowan, okay, who got mad at me because I didn't have him as my best man. I had Jimmer Krantz, who was friends with Jeff Cooper when we went to high school together, and he was my best man. Anyways, make a long story short, fucking this bitch fucking punches me, okay? Thinks it's okay. And I bitch slapped him. I said, get the fuck off me, bitch, you know? And then I ended up knocking a fucking bouncer off. And guess what? In front of a judge, this female actually told the truth. She said, well, I hit him first, you know, because he called me a pet bitch. And the judge was like, case dismissed. Feel me? Okay? So no, I'm not Cary Grant. And yeah, Jeff Cooper is correct. My story is true. I could be Cinder Fella, okay? I was sold out for my first $1 million opportunity, not football wise. I mean, Bob, if an NFL scout tells me that you're for sure first round pick, how am I looking at? In 1985, 1986.
Right? Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, I'm a millionaire, okay? Well, that was from football. I should have been there from going in front of a jury and saying, look, I got fucking expelled for the bullshit that I didn't do. You know the story, Bob. If you were on a jury hearing my case when I got kicked out of Notre Dame, how many millions would you give me back then?
A lot, because, you know, you suffered a lot as a result.
Oh, straight up. Okay, I've heard 5, 10, 15 million. Okay, you know, that's not the first time. How about when my dead uncle, okay, he invests like $1.5 million in Tom Lee's company because Ludamax Nutraceuticals is fucking taking bitches that, ladies, females that are in a wheelchair with MS, and they're taking this natural shit because it has a lot of luteolin in it, and she's not in a wheelchair 18 months down the road, but she's running a fucking triathlon, okay? Now, if that magic happens for her, when I called Tom Leahy, and I did it on purpose, man. I knew what I was doing. It was a baited hook. I said, hey, Tom, guess what? Bobby Chacon, do you know who he is? You know who he is, Bob, don't you?
Right.
Bobby Chacon, homie. I've seen Bobby Chacon on a television show with Muhammad Ali, and there was another great fighter, and they were talking about the best fighter pound for pound of all time, okay? Bobby Chacon was bad. He was 135 pounds and knocked out 47 fucking guys, okay? And I told Tom, hey, guess what? I got Bobby on, Manatech. Okay, Manatech, this shit that brought the line of Wall Street back. fact, this guy was fucking basically brain dead from a fucking stroke, and he took this Manitech stuff that anybody can buy, and it's on the market, and he came back. And Tom goes, no, I've got some shit that'll bring fucking Bobby back in like 12, 18 hours, okay? We're going to inject Bobby with some natural shit, Bobby's going to eat some shit, and something else, right? And I'm like, cha-ching, and then you know what happened, Bob? I fucked up. I got stoned, and I told Tom Leahy my diabolical plan. I had been nominated for quote of the year, right? I was going to Las Vegas, and I was going to read my fucking poems in front of like 5,000 to 15,000 people from all over the world that had come to this poetry convention. And I told Tom Leahy that I was going to have Bobby read my poems and pretend to be the emissary contacted by aliens, okay? And telling us, we got to get our shit straight or we're going to kill this planet and it's done, okay? Don't you, I mean, seriously, think about that, Bob. That's not bullshit. That's a fucking, a realistic opportunity, okay? And you know what, fucking, okay, if Bobby Chacon is in Las Vegas 100% cured, reading poems, saying that he's contacted by aliens, what do you think the fucking fallout would have been in the newspapers, Bob?
Big time.
It would have been huge, right? Eventually,
1 minute remaining.
1 minute remaining. Can I call you back, Bob?
Actually, I got my phone's dying, and I gotta get up early tomorrow for work.
Is it okay? You know what, Bob? Thank you very much. I've had opportunities to be a millionaire before, Jeff Cooper. I love you like a brother. Okay. Help your friend out, man. I said that if I was the richest guy, not even the richest guy on the planet, man. You know, if I was Craig Tuscher rich, like $110 million, and I don't even know the name, but they're in the Silicon Valley. I would fucking pay off all the debts for everybody that went to high school with. Help your friend Dan Quinn get his Stevie Discovery famous. It's my discovery that getting all that toxic soap out of water turns it into what acts like a fountain of youth, okay? When I got arrested here, Bob, I was like fucking 9% body fat. I was 205 pounds. Now I'm 245 pounds. I got a little belly on me, okay? And when I eventually get released from being a political prisoner, because that's what I am, if I had money, you know that I'd be free right now, right?
Yes.
Thank you for using IC Solutions. Goodbye.
Get over here!
Live here on Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson, and I hope you enjoyed our update with Dan Quinn from the Sacramento County Jail. Dan called me yesterday. I wasn't able to answer his phone call, but we're trying to get some questions written down for Dan so that we can really ask him everything that's on everybody's mind out there. Okay? So look forward to that here on Carson's Corner pretty soon. Okay? Now, our guest co-host from time to time, Justin Ray Harvey, interviewed David Wirth of Kickboxer. He's the director of the movie Kickboxer, and he also has directed several movies. I don't recall how many movies he's directed, but a decent amount. You can actually visit that on the Internet Movie Database website. Just type in David Wirth. And Justin had an opportunity to interview him. And so here it is. Here is Justin Ray Harvey's interview with David Wirth. We're going to let this interview conclude the show. But before we get to the interview, I just want to tell you, you could friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. You could also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/BobCarsonMMA. And if you're interested in political issues, you would probably enjoy my progressive podcast, which is also heard on this station right here at blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. So make sure to check that out as well. So here is our friend Justin Ray Harvey interviewing David Wirth, the director of Kickboxer, and I hope you guys enjoy this. And until next time, show some respect.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Justin Ray Harvey here, and have I got a spectacular interview for you today on this Saturday evening. Today I will be interviewing via Skype, by video chat, live, the director of Kickboxer, also the head director of photography of Bloodsport, David Wirth, yes, the legendary David Wirth, via Skype here in just a few moments. Also, he worked with a couple of films with Clint Eastwood, He also did the film Honor. I mean, this guy's resume is completely awesome, and I gotta say, David is a wonderful person to know. I've been emailing him and talking with him for a very long time, so without further ado, let's video call Mr. David Worth. Let me make sure I got my volume to my liking, folks. So, here we go. Hey, David.
Hey, Justin. How you doing, dude?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, David?
Great. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too, my friend. I got to say, David, this, for me, this is a dream come true to actually see you live and be recording you and let you tell your thoughts and opinions and your story. This is truly a dream come true for me.
Well, I'm thrilled to be able to visit with you, Justin. You're a real cool dude. I'm so happy that you have checked out my work, know what I've done, and wanted to chat with me about it. I'm happy to share my experiences anytime with anyone, and I'm more than happy to share them with you.
Awesome, David. So since Bloodsport is my absolute favorite, why don't we start with Bloodsport, if you don't mind?
I don't mind at all. I noticed one of your is it your email address? Is Frank Dukes?
Yeah, frankdukesfan@gmail.com.
Yeah, so I know that you're a big fan of Bloodsport. Frank was there with us when we shot it. He's a great guy, and I'm so happy that that you and Frank are friends.
Oh, it's a dream come true. I mean, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like having Christmas every morning, knowing Frank and being surrounded by, you know, Bloodsport and Kickboxer, because I grew up on those films.
That's wonderful. And, you know, you'd be surprised. I have many of my students and many people who meet me over the years. That's the one thing they say to me. Oh, when I was young, my dad and I used to watch Bloodsport. One of my first films I saw that I remember is Kickboxer. So I'm happy to have that connection with the next generation. I'm kind of the older generation at this point.
Absolutely, and I have to say that both films are classics in my mind. I mean, anybody that's a martial artist, whether they like Frank or not, I guarantee you they've seen Kickboxer or Bloodsport or both.
Oh, yes. No, everyone has seen, especially Bloodsport. I think Bloodsport even made, because it was the first one that really had brought martial arts back since Enter the Dragon. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge hit, and everyone is really fixed on that film. And then they've also, you know, they followed it up with Kickboxer. I think I've had more people talk to me about Bloodsport even than Kickboxer. And what was unique about that film was Jean-Claude.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who Jean-Claude Van Damme was when I went to interview for doing that film. In fact, I was working, doing a very big second unit on a film called Inner Space,
uh-huh.
A big special effects movie at Warner Brothers. I was director of photography on the second unit on that film.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan and a lot of people were in that movie. It was a big special effects movie. I think it won the Academy Award for special effects, in fact. It was produced by Steven Spielberg, etc. And I went in to interview for this little movie that was going to shoot in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very interested in that because my wife is Chinese from Singapore. So I hadn't worked in that part of the world. I was very anxious to go there. And I had no idea who Jean-Claude Van Damme was. But when the producer introduced me to the director was Newt Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
And Newt had been an assistant director to guys like Sam Peckinpah,
mm-hmm.
and William Friedkin. And so I fell in love with Newt and said, oh, I want to do this film just to work with Newt Arnold, mm-hmm. who's worked with all of my hero directors.
Absolutely. absolutely. And I'm actually gonna steal this from Frank, because I've told you this before, but it's appropriate for this video. When I first lived my dream and met Frank and got to, you know, do a video interview with him, I did a 20-minute interview with him, and one of the things that really stuck out with me during the whole thing was he said that David Worth is a brilliant mind to work with. I mean, that's always stuck with me to this day.
That's very complimentary. I'm happy to hear that from Frank.
I'll have to send you the video sometime through email or something.
Yeah, great, no problem.
So,
no, Frank and I were in touch. Frank and I have—I found Frank on FaceTime,
mm-hmm.
Not on FaceTime, on Facebook.
Facebook.
And contacted him and wished him all the best. It's been many years since Bloodsport, but I wished him all the best, and he told me about some things he was doing. So I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook just because I just don't have the time. I'm busy teaching classes and traveling to San Francisco and writing classes for online and doing books and et cetera, et cetera. But when I do check it out, I try to check in with people I've worked with and say hi.
Oh, absolutely, folks, because when I contacted David, I didn't expect you to respond so quickly, but you responded quickly.
I respond, I'm one of those persons that respond immediately to any email, any message that I get. Some people never even answer back to texts or to emails. They just, I don't know, it just kind of goes into the void. But I'm one of those people that if people have taken the time to send me something and would like a response, I'm more than happy to do it. And I've done it with students and with people who have contacted me from all corners of the world, Africa and South America and Europe and Asia, who happened across either me on Facebook or my IMDb or something like that, or my website that has my email address, and contact me, and I respond right away. And if they want me to chat with them about any films, I'm more than happy to do it. I'm very accessible.
Okay, and I'd like to ask this, like, with Bloodsport, because I know that you was head of photography. Did everything go as planned as you wanted it to, or was you kind of, you know, disappointed in some areas where this could have been better, or, you know, that could have been better? I mean, what was your biggest challenge with Bloodsport?
Well, the biggest challenge with it was, and by the way, I'm very satisfied with the photography of Bloodsport. I don't have any problems with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was extremely satisfied with everyone in the film, especially Mr. Van Damme, and how the film turned out, and of course it basically launched his career. But the biggest challenge was never having worked in Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
never having worked with an all-Chinese crew, and when I walked into the set, and the air-conditioned soundstage where the Kumite was, it was a four-wall, ceiling-in set with the mat in the center and with a balcony and with grandstands in it for people to sit around. It was a 360-degree room. That wasn't a regular soundstage where you can move walls and move things to facilitate your lighting. So I looked at that, and I said, there's only one way to light this, and I have to light it the way Stanley Kubrick would have lit it.
Mm-hmm.
I studied Stanley Kubrick's work before I even did Bronco Billy with Clint Eastwood, and I discovered that Stanley Kubrick builds all of his lighting
mm-hmm.
into his sets or locations so that he never has to break up the actor's concentration when they're on a roll. He can just keep shooting without having to change lights.
Mm-hmm.
So I adapted that way. Once I realized that's what he was doing, I adapted that way as my way of working. I even wrote an article in the American Cinematographer magazine that was entitled, "If It's Good Enough for Mr. Kubrick, ... Why aren't more of us doing that?"
Mm-hmm.
So I had used it successfully on Bronco Billy, and I walked in and I saw that huge four-walled, ceilinged and floored
mm-hmm.
set that was on a big soundstage in Hong Kong, and I knew I had to figure a way to build all my lighting into the set. So fortunately, the ceiling had beams in it, and I was able to tell my gaffer, 1K, 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 1K. I was able to place enough lights on the beams in the ceiling to make them look like normal lights that would be at a theatrical event. I didn't put any barn doors or filters or anything like that on them. Mm-hmm. And we focused some on the mat, some on the crowd, and some on the Kumite officials that were at the stand in front of the mat, and one on the scoreboard. And then we placed 150-watt bulbs all the way around on both the balcony level, mm-hmm. The walls on the floor level, so we'd have a little bit of we could see what was kind of in the background, have a little distance. And basically, that was it. The set was lit.
Wow.
I lit it specifically, and I'm going to be a little technical here, Justin, for the mm-hmm. photographers who are out there. I lit it to an F4.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that because I knew I was going to be shooting slow motion at 48 frames and 96 frames. Some of the highlights we would shoot in slow motion at 48 frames. Some of the highlights we'd shoot in slow motion at 96 frames. And I knew that I needed to have an F4 everywhere in that ring. So whenever Newt Arnold said, all right, we're going to shoot at 48 frames, mm-hmm. I would open up a stop to a 2.8. If he said we're going to shoot at 96 frames, I'd open up two stops to a 2.2 or a 2.4.
Mm-hmm.
And my set was ready. It was completely lit. And they could bring fights in all day long. And we would cover them with three Panavision cameras. And we just shot the heck out of those scenes.
Wow, and one thing that I've always wanted to know, because I think Frank had told me some stuff from the film had got cut that he wanted to keep in there, or he wanted some more fights that was cut or something in the film. Because me and Frank actually watched the film together, actually. So.
Well, you know, when you shoot a film, Justin, you shoot a lot more than you need.
Mm-hmm.
And on this particular film, on Bloodsport, Newt Arnold, it was the first film he had worked on as a director. He'd been an assistant director, as I said, for really big guys like William Friedkin and Sam Peckinpah. But this was his first film as a director. He was very prepared. He had all kinds of notes and drawings. Mm-hmm. And he over-covered it. We shot three cameras, three Panavision cameras on every fight scene, and we covered every fight from like six different angles. We would shoot three cameras from wide angles, like shooting through the crowd or from behind the officials, and then one camera would always be on a dolly or on a crane going up and down looking at the ring or dollying around the ring. Then we'd come in closer. And two of the cameras were always concentrating on each of the fighters and following them everywhere on the mat.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would take the camera handheld and get onto the mat and shoot certain portions of the fight handheld. Then we would shoot the highlight kick or knockout in 48 frames or 96 frames slow motion. So we shot almost 240,000 feet of film on that whole film, and we shot a lot of fights. And by the time... the film is going to only end up being 10,000 feet long,
mm-hmm.
An hour and a half movie.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you do the editing process, there are things that are going to be eliminated. And that's just part of, it happens with every film, and that's part of getting down the film to the right length for the distributor, because every distributor says you will deliver a film between 90 and 100 minutes. They give you a mark to hit. And so I'm sure in hitting that mark, there were some choice scenes and choice fights and choice kicks and punches that had to be eliminated.
Absolutely. And what I would really love to see for old and new generation that love Bloodsport.
It's 2:00.
As you know, they just had the 25th anniversary of Bloodsport. I would love to see like a re-release where it would have you doing commentary about the film or something, you know, some extra features.
Well, I would love to. But I might be kind of down on the pecking order of people to make comments. They probably would go to Mr. Van Damme before they would come to me to make comments, but I'd be more than happy to do it. Unfortunately, Newt Arnold, the director, has passed away, but I would love to see that. I'd love to see them include any of the outtakes and photos and behind the scenes and all that kind of stuff. I would be more than happy to do it. I was director of photography on a film that became a cult film called Poor Pretty Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
With Shelley Winters and Leslie Uggams and Slim Pickens and Dub Taylor and Ted Cassidy. And the young star was Michael Christian, who was on the original Peyton Place.
Mm-hmm.
And it never did anything when we released it back in the 1970s, but eventually it became a cult favorite. And they did a re-release of it a couple of years ago, and they called me and they had me sit with it and do a scene-by-scene commentary on that film.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm more than happy to do it for any of my old lost films.
Oh, absolutely. And my final question, so that we can move on to Kickboxer, because I could talk about Bloodsport all day. I mean, but
I could we can concentrate on Bloodsport all you'd like, Justin. Even if after we talk about Kickboxer, we can come back to Bloodsport.
Okay. Well, one of my questions is for my fans too is like. Forrest Whitaker was awesome in that film, but what was funny about it, and I want to know how this came up, this funny idea where, you know, he speaks, you know, and then he gets interrupted through the whole film, except at the very end. It's hilarious.
Yes. Well, my memory is lapsing on the actor he played opposite, the other detective. I can't quite remember his name. He's a great character actor.
Yeah.
But Forrest and he worked that out. They had normal lines written in the script.
Mm-hmm.
And Forrest and he, on their own, worked out that would be their little M.O. Every time something would happen, Forrest would start talking, and then he would come in, the other guy would come in and interrupt and finish it off. And that made them stand out and be unique in the film because really, I mean, the film is about martial arts and Jean-Claude Van Damme and fights and all that. And they found a way to make their performance memorable. And what I loved about it was having Forrest in the film, because before our film came out, I then saw him in Color of Money,
mm-hmm.
with Paul Newman, upstaging Paul Newman in a scene. And when we had the premiere, I went to him and I said, Forrest, my God, you're such a great actor. We're honored to have had you in our little martial arts film. I just saw Color of Money, and you've got a big career. Anyone who could upstage Paul Newman is pretty amazing actor. And I said, you've got a career ahead of you. And of course, he won the Academy Award, and it's still going on. He's just he's a great director, actor, etc. He was just in the film The Butler, which I haven't seen yet.
It looks like it's going to be a good film. I've seen the previews of that.
Yeah, he's a we just were at the right place at the right time, and he was at the beginning of his career, and he came to Hong Kong and did a little martial arts film, and I always smile every time I see him there because he's the one who had the smallest part in the film, and he's the one who went the furthest of all of us.
Yeah, exactly, because he doesn't get a full line until after the film is completely almost over at the very end.
That's right.
It's hilarious, and but before I move to Kickboxer, one thing that just popped into my mind, walk us through that video game scene where Frank is meeting Ray Jackson for the first time. Can you walk us through that scene?
We shot all the two shot and the close-ups of Ray and of Jean-Claude playing the game, pretending to play the game.
Yeah.
We didn't have the game even when we were shooting. They added that game. They shot all the footage for the game and added that in post-production.
Or we
may have even shot it when we were at some point in Hong Kong. They may have brought it to me and we may have shot it on set. I can't quite recall, but I know it was a completely separate item.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to react. They had to pretend to react to what the game was going to be doing, and then we had to make the game do it and shoot it and put it all together in the editing.
That had to be really tough if you think about it, you know, to do
that. Yeah, but that's what acting is about. Acting, especially even today, with all the green screen and superhero and mega monster things they're doing, they don't have those things for the actors to react to. They have a stick with a green tennis ball on it that they're holding up out of frame, and they're having the actors react, look at the right spot,
mm-hmm.
and then later they're going to put the monster or the dragon in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely, and let's go ahead and
One thing more.
Okay.
I want to talk about Bloodsport.
Okay.
That all the women, you know, that's the main thing that Bloodsport did. That's the main thing that Jean-Claude Van Damme did for martial arts. The last star we had before Jean-Claude was, of course, the great Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And then that ended, and then martial arts kind of went away, and Jean-Claude came back onto the scene with Bloodsport. And because he had ballet training and could do the splits, and because he was cute and very handsome, because he had a great body, and because he had a French accent, he brought something to Bloodsport and to martial arts that no one had ever been able to bring. He brought women to the audience.
He
was able to bring women to the audience. The women didn't care about martial arts. It was a guy's thing to go see martial arts movies and kung fu movies. But because of his charm and his accent and his looks, he was able to bring women to our audience, which expanded it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no idea how many women stopped me when they found out I did Bloodsport and said that they remember the scene where he showed his butt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very famous scene, actually.
The love scene the next morning, where he's getting up and getting dressed after he's had the scene with the journalist, and we were rolling the camera, and he had his pants already up, and he just quickly pulled them down and pulled them back up, and he almost improvised it. I just smiled to myself. We shot it, and that ended up being the thing that the female audience hooked on. And
they said,
oh my God, when we saw that scene, that was just fantastic. So that's the amazing thing that Mr. Van Damme brought to martial arts with the women. Excuse me, I need a drink of water.
That's okay, because I've got my coffee here, so yeah.
Okay, kickboxer.
Yes, let's move on to kickboxer, because not only is Kickboxer a great film, but you were the director of Kickboxer.
Yes.
So,
and that,
how did that all come about? And because a lot of people say that it's similar to Bloodsport, that it could have, you know, got the idea from Bloodsport.
Excuse me, David. I'm getting over a cold, Justin. Rephrase that question so you don't have to leave me blowing my nose in the video. You can edit it out. I just had a cold last week, and I'm just on the last end of it. Excuse me. Go ahead.
That could be a blooper reel.
Okay, on the beat reel.
Yeah, but my question is, David, how did Kickboxer, you know, come about? Because I get into a lot of debates with people online that say that, you know, it's basically Bloodsport, you know.
Except with a love story.
Yeah.
And different characters, and only one bad guy instead of a lot of bad guys, you know, et cetera. Instead of Bolo, it's Tong Po, so.
Yeah. Which is Michelle Kesey.
And
I read somewhere.
Michelle was in Bloodsport. Did you know that?
Yes. He's the one that gets his knee broken.
That's right.
Yes.
And then he shaved his head, or we put a thing on him for Kickboxer, and he became a whole different character.
they said that it took them an hour to make him look like that. With the adjustments that they had to make. So.
Well, here's how it came about. The producer had, when we were shooting on location, when we were shooting Bloodsport, I kept saying to the producer, I want to direct the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw how well I got on with the crew, how I ran the crew, how I pre-lit the sets, how efficient the production was run. And by the way, when we were shooting Bloodsport, the Kumite sequences, because I had the set pre-lit and because I had three cameras, we were able to average 70 setups a day.
Wow.
And I had a high one day of 93. This is one of the most efficient films ever made, trust me on that. And the producer saw that, and then when we'd finished and he was preparing Kickboxer, he brought me in and said, all right, prove to me how much you want to direct this next film and come in and help out during pre-production for no money. Just show me, roll up your sleeves and get involved. And I did that for 6 months. I polished the script. I worked on the advertising campaign. We didn't think we were going to get Jean-Claude Van Damme back. We even ran casting sessions in case we didn't get Jean-Claude back. I did all my storyboards for the film and basically proved to him that I was the guy to direct the film, and eventually he signed me to direct it. And when there was a center page ad in Variety that read that beautiful red thing of Jean-Claude with the kick, and it said you know, Kings Road Entertainment is announcing a film produced by Mark Dassalle starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, directed by David Wirth, blah blah blah. And that was how we did it.
Wow, that's just amazing, David. And the shooting was in Thailand, correct?
The shooting was we placed the film in Thailand. Yes, we went to Thailand three different times in pre-production. Before, I wasn't the director of photography on that show. We had another gentleman doing it because I was directing. But I shot all the stuff in pre-production. We took the cameras and went to Thailand to scout locations three different times. And I shot all of the stuff, all of the locations at the temple and the city and the exteriors and all the stuff with the boats that we used for the main title sequence. I shot all of that material in pre-production while we were scouting Thailand, because we actually built the Thai village and a lot of the film in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was where Solon Films was, and that was our center for shooting both all of Bloodsport and then 75% of Kickboxer. But we had placed it as happening in Thailand because of all the second unit footage that I shot in pre-production around Thailand.
I see. And one of my favorite scenes from the film was when he was kicking the palm tree. That is one of my favorite scenes.
That was shot in Hong Kong. That's one of our favorite scenes too, because it's a very emotional scene. Jean-Claude and David Chow, his trainer, have a clashing of heads, and the trainer says, "Oh, you don't want training, okay?" And then Jean-Claude proves to him how much he wants it. Of course, we had a big pad on the other side of the tree where you couldn't see it, where Jean-Claude could safely kick the tree, and we had the tree wired so at a certain point we could pull it down and give the impression that he was doing it, breaking it with his leg. But and then Jean-Claude brought all of his emotion to it and played the pain and the girl coming to help him and all that. But it was a very, very good scene, a very well done scene that required a lot of things to be correct and safe. We couldn't do anything to endanger Mr. Van Damme, so the tree was padded and the tree was wired to work mechanically and follow the arc of the story of him being able to kick that tree down and impress his master.
And I gotta say, David, the guy that played, I can't think of his real name because Kickboxer's the only film I've seen him in. The guy that played Winston Taylor, that part was just genius.
Haskell Vaughn Anderson III.
That was just genius. I mean, the way you had him do his parts and his role in Kickboxer, it was just, it was great.
Haskell Von Anderson III, a great actor. He does a lot of theater now. And 25 years down the road, a great actor, a great man.
Wow. And one of the questions I wanted to ask David is, where did you get the idea for the hands wrapped in glass, you know, thing for the fight?
This was in the script. This was in the script. And John Claude and the producer really did the script together. There was the other writer. I don't have all of those technical credits at my disposal. But that was in the script. And so we showed the scene again of them breaking the real glass into the containers. Then we changed containers and we put chipped pieces of plastic in there, and then we showed them putting the glue on their gloves and pushing their hands down in and coming up with the glass on them. Yeah, it was a very, very squeamish scene. You know when people are putting glass on their fists, you don't want to see the result.
Yeah, well, I actually enjoyed that fight scene. Actually, it was very well put together. And I wanted to mention to the audience, and I wanted to get your opinion on this too, David. There is actually a scene from the movie that I found on YouTube. There was a scene that was cut from the U.S. release where David Sloan visits Eric in the hospital, and it's a very emotional scene.
Yes.
And to this day, David, I'm like, why did they not keep that in there? Because that is such a great scene.
No, I agree. Again, that was one of those things that the American distributor had agreed on a certain amount of time, and they probably had to make a time limit, and they said, we got to cut two more minutes or 2.5 more minutes or 3 more minutes out of the film. What are we going to take? And that became the thing. They said, well, it's not action, so we'll take that. And we've seen Jean-Claude's emotion, of course, when he cries, when he finds out about his brother's back and this and that. So I'm sure that that just got cut by a process of elimination. But I remember shooting the scene. I remember it was a very good scene. And Jean-Claude was always in top form in every scene. He was prepared and ready, both physically and emotionally, to do the part.
And how long did it take to finish filming and making sure everything was good to go?
Well, here's what I was able to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
As the director of Kickboxer, as opposed to Bloodsport, as I told you on Bloodsport, we shot almost 250,000 feet of film, and we shot for 8 weeks in only in Hong Kong to get the material for the film. I was able to streamline the production because of my experience as a director, of photography, and an editor. I was able to streamline Kickboxer, so I only shot 125,000 feet of film on Kickboxer, and I shot it in 2 countries, and I shot it in 6 weeks.
Wow.
In 36 days, even though we went to Thailand and Hong Kong.
That would seem tedious to me, David, to do that.
Yeah, I was able to streamline it, to shoot less film, to concentrate more on the story, and to get the same production value, but not overcovering it, not doing. I just thought that the first film had been overcovered, which was, that's always the director's choice. That was Newt's choice, and my choice was to be just a little more streamlined. But we shot it in 6 weeks.
I got to be honest with you, David. If there was any chance in the world that there was ever a film made about my life, which I highly doubt that would ever happen, I think if I could choose my director, I would want you to direct.
Well, I thank you very much. I would be honored. It would be an honor to do a film about you, because you, young man, are a hero to me. Trust me.
Because, like I said, Bloodsport and Kickboxer are just movies to people. But to me, they have made me the strong person I am today.
Excellent.
So, because, I mean, I had many surgeries, and when I was born, David, I wasn't expect to live, or even, I'm going to share this story with you, just, you know, because I've never had the opportunity to share this story with you. They even told my mother when I was born, they said, just stick him in an institution and call it a day. He's not going to be able to feed himself. He's not going to be able to talk. He's not going to be able to do nothing.
Wow. Let me tell you something. You fooled them all, didn't you, Justin?
Yes, I did.
No, and this is wonderful. This is a wonderful story. And you hear these stories a lot of times with athletes who have backs broken and legs broken, and they say, well, you'll never walk again, you'll never run again, you'll never jump again. And that shows you that it's not the physical part of us that keeps us going. It's the emotional and spiritual and mental part of us that drives us, and we can will things to happen with our spirit that people who just look at us physically would say, well, he's not going to be able to do anything, that's it. And your will and your mind and your spirit made it happen. And that's what Bloodsport and Kickboxer are really about. They're about that kind of dominance of the human will and the human spirit. So I'm so happy that those films were able to speak to you and to help you become the wonderful, articulate, brilliant television star that you are.
Yeah, because when little kids was running and playing or doing something that I couldn't do, I mean, absolutely, you know, physically couldn't do, I was sitting here watching Kickboxer and Bloodsport back to back, you know, and I can really, in some degree, you know, even though Kickboxer's not a real story, I can relate to the characters in the film.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, that's what all filmmaking is about. It's about suspending your disbelief and believing this little fantasy about A, B, and C. That's what people have loved about the movies since they first began going and seeing Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin back in the old silent days. It was maybe only 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, but it made them laugh, it made them cry, it made them forget about their ordinary life. And all over the world, people flock to the movies for that reason, because it gives them something that is bigger than life. And the best movies give them something for their mind and their body and their spirit. And I was pleased that I'm very, very honored that our humble little small martial arts films were able to do that.
Oh, absolutely, because my brother would come over to my house a lot, and it didn't matter if I watched Bloodsport 100 times a day, he would always sit down with me and watch the film.
That's wonderful.
So.
I bet you know it better than I do.
I want to quote something that Frank actually said himself, which I wish I would have had this on camera to, you know, substantiate this, but Frank actually said, you know more about Bloodsport than I do.
Yeah, and you know more about Bloodsport than I do, trust me, because I've maybe seen it, you know, I saw it, of course, in the filming of it, in the making of it, all day, every day for 8 weeks. Then I came in and saw various edited versions of it. I saw the premiere of it, and I've watched it, I'd say probably at least a dozen times, because for years there, it was on every week. It was on some channel I'd be turning by, and there it would be, and I'd sit and I'd be enthralled. I'd say, oh, I remember that. That was a great day, and this, and I always go back to the time of the shooting. I enjoy watching it because of that. But you, believe me, have surpassed all of the screenings of Bloodsport that even the makers of the film and even the guy who lived the film, Mr. Dukes, have. You are the champ when it comes to the screenings of Bloodsport.
So you can really understand how much this video interview really means to me, because it's like a dream come true for me to be talking to you live, you know.
Well, I'm happy to do it, Justin. You have my email. You have my cell phone number. You have my Skype. You have my iChat number. You're welcome to contact me anytime just to say hi. I'm not always here. Sometimes I'm traveling, but you can reach me. You can always email me or always cell phone me. I'm happy to say hi and chat with you. You're my buddy as far as I'm concerned.
I appreciate that, David. And I got to say, you have inspired me to try to do something, which I don't know how I'm going to go about it yet. I just got to get this out, though. I actually want to try acting, even if it's just a small part in any type of film or play even. You've inspired me to try that.
Excellent. And, you know, with the advent of high-definition cameras, HD, small HD cameras, this is an HD camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's on your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have your friends come over, and you can record sound on it and video on it, and you even has editing programs on it, or you have it on your iPad. This is what I tell all of my students. I say, nowadays, it's much easier to make films than it was back in my day, when you had to have film and processing and printing and coding, and it would take us months to do what people with a high-def camera and a little nonlinear editing system can do on a weekend. You can have your friends come over with their cell phones or with their DSLRs, their little high-def cameras that look like still cameras, and do little projects with you. Absolutely. Do it.
Absolutely, and I got to say, David, I would love to see a documentary done on you, actually. I would sit down and watch that for hours.
Well, listen, I'm not sure that I have enough gravitas to deserve a documentary. I'm kind of a what I call a journeyman filmmaker. I made some very good films. I did two films with Clint Eastwood, as you know, as his director of photography, Bronco Billy in Any Which Way You Can, which I'm very proud of. I'm extremely proud of being the director of photography on Bloodsport and the director of Kickboxer, which launched Mr. Van Damme's career.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on to do a lot of other films that are not quite that great, but I've worked with Shelley Winters. I worked with Roy Scheider and with Dennis Hopper and with the great Bruce Campbell, who did those wonderful horror films.
Mm-hmm.
So I've made my way. I've managed to eke out a career on not making all big films or all important films, but having enough of a career to support my family and help my son and my wife go